Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, pulling back the curtain on the criminal mind once again as we travel to Newtown Square, Pennsylvania to examine the January 26, 1996 murder of U.S. Olympic wrestler Dave the Hammer Schultz. The 36-year-old athlete died from gunshot wounds inflicted by John DuPont, a wealthy yet eccentric and ultimately disturbed man whose burgeoning psychosis led him to believe he was involved in a love triangle with two of his employees and needed to eliminate his competition, among other things. Now, going all the way back to the beginning of this tale, we find an interesting irony embedded in the disparity between how it starts and how it culminates. The DuPont family, one of the wealthiest in the United States, is known for many products across the chemical and automotive industries, such as Teflon, nylon, and Kevlar, but they got their start with this product, gunpowder. Also known as black powder, gunpowder is the earliest known chemical explosive created by humans. Its earliest incarnations are believed to have originated with the Chinese as far back as the 9th century, and by the 10th century, they instituted the use of metal, or bamboo, fire lances, which projected shrapnel and flames. By the 13th century, gunpowder was being regularly utilized as an explosive in battle, and within 100 years thereafter, battlefields in Europe featured something called cannons, which of course shot large cannonballs, which were often solid iron. Soon enough, those cannonballs were made hollow and subsequently filled with gunpowder, which allowed them to be then known as shells, similar to what we use in modern cannons or artillery. But the need for a handheld, portable version of such a thing arose in the midst of all this innovation, and so we ended up with handguns. And a larger handgun, such as something like a 357 Magnum, is often affectionately referred to as a hand cannon due to its power. It uses bullets, of course, which are essentially a miniature version of a shell. Metal encases gunpowder. Needless to say, by the time the DuPont family got involved in the manufacture of gunpowder, guns of all types were available to military and private citizens. So guns became a significant part of the DuPont family's culture, along with hunting, and those values were passed down from generation to generation, something of which John DuPont was a part. The estate he lives on as an adult in Newtown Square, PA, is a wooded area in Bucks County, known for ample hunting spots despite its close proximity to Philadelphia. In fact, you could say the 1,000-acre estate was a world of its own, closed off from the outside, open by invitation only. And John was the sheriff. He was the top dog. He almost always carried a gun. He didn't want to seem threatening. He just wanted control without asking for it. John DuPont was a highly introverted, socially inhibited individual who was born into a family that came prepackaged with the necessity to be a worldly socialite. John was incapable of such a thing, and therefore was excused from a strong sense of normalcy throughout his childhood. He was socially inept to an extent he didn't even eat meals with his immediate family until he reached age 13. They would send a maid up to his room to feed him privately. He was locked away, hidden. But something within him was dying to get out. And of course, if he finally came out of his room at age 13, something undoubtedly compelled him to do so. And if you ask me what consumes the mind of a 13-year-old male, it's his sexuality. For John, this is a very complicated and delicate subject. He realizes he's gay, and whether he accepts it or not, or even acknowledges it at all, his paranoia about remaining closeted certainly didn't help his troubled social interactions. If he can't bring himself to face the world as a child, how will he be able to properly address his sexuality in adulthood? Well, he won't. And that's why we're all here today. John DuPont didn't just live on an estate. It was a world all his own. He made the rules. He was the law. But what was really scary is that he also dictated the logic. The people who lived and worked on John DuPont's estate were subjected to an alternate reality, and pretended, appeasing John for what they got in exchange. But this was a deal with the devil. The longer it went on, one thing became clear. Someone was going to die. And sadly, that person became Dave Schultz. So John is a social nightmare for the most part, with one foot stuck in denial and the other mired in fear. He's not going to live an authentic life as an openly gay man, and only occasionally dates a woman to keep up appearances, so to speak. Basically, John is ensuring unhappiness in his personal life by not indulging innovation from his dilemma of wanting to be himself, but also being crippled by fear and social deficiencies. He's not going to choose one side of the fence or the other. He's going to straddle the middle on those ideals. And guess what? When John is 30 years old and living that inauthentic life, he knows he still has the opportunity to change. There's always hope when you have time. But when we wait around in fear, telling ourselves tomorrow is a better time to change and finally be ourselves, tragedy somehow seems to strike. We get a very big wake-up call. And for John, once again, the irony is nearly too much to bear. While riding a horse, it bucks him off, and he lands testicles first on a fence, causing extensive damage to that area, leading to infection and ultimately removal of those testicles. It's said John became androgynous at that point to a degree it was obvious to others. This is a huge blow to him psychologically. What was already a difficult situation in relation to his sexuality has now become much more complicated, perhaps even irreconcilable, against his hopes for whatever life he really wanted to lead. In the aftermath of such a thing, it wouldn't be unnatural at all for a man to experience feelings of inadequacy, even if reproduction wasn't a goal for him. John always had an abnormal experience emotionally as it pertains to his sexuality, and this incident paralleled that notion, but on a physical level this time. Accordingly, we should expect John to take some type of action to correct this in the next phase of his life moving forward. If we could whittle his emotional wound down to a few words, I'd generally say that he feels like less than a man. He thinks being gay is something for which he should be ashamed. And of course, for someone who was born in 1938 into a wealthy family, society definitely would have precipitated that fear and also fueled that shame through abundant ignorance. It certainly isn't fair, but in combination with the physical accident and John's pre-existing state of emotional withdrawal, these factors create the perfect storm that leave him feeling trapped. What does he do? And when we get to that place, things spill over. They manifest in the real world. So ask yourself, if you were a man and quote-unquote feeling like less of a man, what actions could you take to feel more powerful? I don't mean emotional change. I mean physical action to compensate for the psychological effects of inadequacy. I mean, if we're talking about most of the population, you could just try to become more powerful, right? You could get a better job, a nicer car, greater status, maybe even a gun if that's your thing. But John has all that. He always did. And much more. None of it made a difference. It didn't solve anything. And without the capacity for emotional change, he'll ask how he can alter his physical reality. Now, as we just discussed, referencing John's childhood, what's his Achilles heel? Interaction. More specifically, interaction with other people. So, if you wanted to feel like more of a man, so to speak, and didn't like interaction, what might you do? Well, you might get involved in sports to feel strong and capable. Sports that allow you to defeat others in victory, but for which there is no interaction. Athletics is the arena in which John has never really succeeded on a high level and has wanted to. It's the thing he doesn't have. But we know he feels grounded. How? Well, after college, guess what John DuPont achieved? He was responsible for the discovery of approximately 24 bird species. He was obsessed with the fascination of them taking flight. They were everything he was not. We're talking about someone who was arrested at the same house where he was born. His emotional world was insulated from reality, and so was his estate. And notice that John, prior to smashing his nuts on the fence, was obsessed with birds in flight, with studying how they do what they do, and capturing their beauty. But as soon as he has the accident, what does his primary interaction with birds become? Killing them. With a gun. He hunts them on his estate, where he's grounded. And we know he wants to be them. He's come to hate them, and we'll know that by the nickname that he chooses, which we'll talk about in a minute. So, John fights his feelings of inadequacy by getting involved in sports. But what we notice is that the sports he chooses are indicative of his inability to interact with others. He doesn't primarily fund interactive sports such as soccer, football, baseball, lacrosse, or anything like that. He chooses swimming, track and field, and things of that nature, solitary pursuits in which you compete against others but don't interact directly. These choices are quite relevant to his emotional state. John DuPont loves to compete, but he does not like to interact with other people. But like I said, his true desires will manifest from that fear-filled version over time. As he becomes more desperate and remains unable to communicate what he truly wants, either to himself or others, it will have to surface by way of fate. And it does. That's when John discovers wrestling. Of course, there's the ridiculous notion that people will sometimes joke about regarding wrestlers, which is that they just want to roll around on the floor with other men. Again, that's normally a pretty silly observation, but in John's case, there is some truth to it. He can't bring himself to indulge his true sexuality, so he has to employ a facade to get closer. Now, on top of that, wrestlers are a really tough crowd. These guys are absolute beasts in terms of physical prowess. If you climb the ranks of Olympic wrestling, you're basically an alpha male, at least from a physical standpoint. The level of athleticism required in that sport is staggering. So, if you're John and can't cure your emotional issue of feeling inadequate because of your orientation and the accident, among other things, being able to hang with top wrestlers is a very macho thing to do. There is nothing physically inadequate about those men on the mat. They'll crush you. And John wants to be that guy. But he can't. That's not how he was created. So what is he going to do? He's going to manipulate that circumstance. He'll force a scenario in which he can barter his money in exchange for false perception. If everyone agrees to pretend he's the alpha, he'll pay them off. Unfortunately, what that's going to do is turn a perfectly legitimate athletic endeavor, meaning USA Wrestling, into a cult in which John can pretend to be the alpha male if all these real alpha males are willing to pretend. They'll humor him. And that's really fucking dangerous because he has a lot of money. He'll keep offering more. And accordingly, his standard of control and leverage increases. If they need his money, they'll have to concede more and more to acquire it. That leads to a place in which John has not only created a new identity for himself as an alpha male on a physical level, but one that becomes verified through the athlete's acquiescence that's required to keep his financial support going. Over time, the athletes will lose agency over themselves in favor of appeasing John. Basically, like I said, this dude started a cult. He used money as a ploy for emotional control. And once it happened, once everybody appeased him, he believed his logic was correct. So in essence, No matter what John said or did, they agreed with him. That's okay to a certain extent, because he employs them, but it continued even after he began having hallucinations. People would still agree with him because they had something to lose, which was his financial support and training facilities. Unfortunately, on the day of the murder, the Olympic trials were only 6 months away. Many of the athletes living on the estate felt like there was too much to lose to leave at that point. Of course, John knew that, and he took advantage of it by imposing his will. For everybody involved, the situation at the estate was becoming increasingly untenable. At some point, it was going to boil over. And when it did, you could be sure John DuPont's real problem, the one that started it all, would come to light. It did, and it ended in murder. So let's take this back to even before the start of the Foxcatcher wrestling program on the DuPont estate. Wrestling, again, is an interactive sport, meaning the participants face off directly against one another, either coming in contact and/or using a shared object of some type, such as a ball. Wrestling is perhaps the most interactive of sports, as your opponent's body itself is the focus. There's a lot of aggressive contact, often involving skin-to-skin situations, grabbing the legs and the crotch, and other manners of strategy that are applicable to being effective. The overwhelming majority of gay men in society wouldn't join a wrestling program as a means of getting physically close to other men. But John DuPont is terrified of his sexuality, mentally unhinged, emotionally damaged, and exceptionally introverted. He needs a facade of legitimacy to explore this, and he has the money to do it. He needs it to look like he's a big bad alpha male on the outside, and behind the scenes, he's going to begin to insert himself into increasingly homoerotic situations with certain athletes at the estate. But no matter how manipulative he becomes, the extent of what his money is able to buy doesn't include being perceived as the alpha in this world he's created. The other men see Dave Schultz as the alpha. So this tragedy comes to bear as a result of a disparity between what the athletes led John to believe and what was really the truth. They told him he was the top dog to his face, but then they behaved like Dave Schultz was really the alpha male. In the end, John believed his only way to earn that respect was to kill. And that's what happened. So let's document the psychological descent now. So John grew up isolated on the estate, mostly in the company of his mother, as his siblings were all much older, and he didn't have the benefit of playing alongside other neighborhood children like most kids. Obviously, that situation was the start of his social difficulties, and we get a sense this kid was quite lonely. But what we can say for sure is that he was not accustomed to interaction with others, especially when it comes to touching. So again, that will precipitate John's initial inclination towards sports which aren't interactive, like swimming and track and field events, which put others close to him, but not intimately. That's the first phase of him trying to get close to people socially. But once he does that, he has the desire for more, as is normal. This isn't really about sports for him. It is on some level, because yes, he loves to compete, but it's more so about socialization. Sports became John's bridge to meeting other people. John doesn't have another conduit for making friends or finding a lover. Given his ample fear, he starts with sports that aren't interactive, surrounding himself with success and legitimacy as a sponsor, and soon he desires to take that socialization to the next level. He's always been a participant in the sports, along with funding them. But let's be honest, John is lonely. He doesn't have any type of life partner, and he has desires, just like everyone else, Yet, in the absence of the social skills required to make himself a viable option for other people, despite his wealth and status. So he wants to take that socialization to the next level, and his only option is money. So wrestling not only crosses the barrier into interactive sports, in which you compete face-to-face with other people, but it also utilizes attractive young men built like they were carved from stone, and it maximizes intimate contact. John has never been one of the guys, so to speak, on a social level, nor has he had a real opportunity to explore his closeted sexuality. That means his goal in wrestling will have three tributaries, so to speak. One is competition. He wants Foxcatcher to be the best. Two is that he wants to be the alpha in the group, or the eagle, to all of these rare, elusive foxes in the form of the wrestlers. He was never that athlete growing up and wanted to be elite like these men. And three is that he wants to fulfill his desires for romantic love and sex, whatever that means to him. Now, I have no doubt John did all sorts of crazy things in his younger days, but where the danger to other people seems to arise is in 1983. John gets in a car accident and injures his hand, which causes him to have to see an occupational therapist for rehab. The 45-year-old John falls for this woman, 29-year-old Gail Wenk, and the two are married soon after. But let's get real. This is a sham. I'm guessing his motivation was equal parts having a facade for a marriage to stop the questions about an aging man's sexuality and Gail's nurturing of his hand. You see, John's mother was getting old, and he knew she didn't have much time left. In fact, she died just 5 years later in 1988. So it's fairly clear John was enthralled by the nurturing aspect of Gail Wenk's care, and fearing his mother's demise in the near future, sought to replace her more or less. He didn't want to be alone. Of course, that's not going to work, and this marriage lasts a few months before Gail moves out of the estate. John reportedly had a lot of anger toward Gail, and on one occasion put a gun to her head and said this is what they do to Russian spies. She also claimed he tried to throw her in a fireplace, and while it couldn't be proven, I'm not sure anybody on earth would doubt her. The rumors about John's behavior were already a thing, but to his detriment and everyone else's, it was considered eccentricity. If you're homeless and you do this, you're crazy. When the wealthy do it, we allow them the privilege of being described as eccentric. I have no doubt John was expecting to get a mother, and Gail, despite probably knowing John was gay, was still expecting to get a husband, even if the circumstances weren't entirely genuine. It was a good trade-off. There's no doubt Gail was turning a blind eye to the truth for money, and of course, that's what John wanted. But this arrangement wasn't going to work. John never married again. But this is what propels him towards sports. His mother is aging, and seemingly the only person who was ever close to him. He's looking for a new family. And part of that search is going to be the hunt for romantic love. So at first, John starts contributing to and participating in local sporting events in swimming and track and field. But he does it outside the estate, choosing to help local universities in the Philadelphia area, such as Villanova. Once Mom dies, however, he's not going to have any family on the estate. There are people there all the time, but in terms of close personal relationships, there's nobody. Now, what we have to realize is that his father left when he was 2 years old, after a divorce from John's mother. So John has abandonment issues to a certain extent. Yes, he's wealthy, but he's grown up without his biological father. So despite the appearance of success, this man is hurting inside because he wanted the love of his father in his life. He wanted empathy from the man. So what we should expect from John, now that he has the resources to be that man for others, is that he'll use his money to build a surrogate family in which he essentially plays the role of the father to his adopted children. Yet just like his own father, he has nothing to offer them but money. So John is going to buy a family and be that surrogate father to them, but he's also going to use that family as a source for finding more intimate relationships because the quote-unquote children are truly grown men. Notice that this is not incest, but it mirrors the construction of incest by keeping these sexual relationships not only inside the family itself, but totally secretive. That's not a coincidence. The DuPont family, like many prominent families of generations past, had a 19th century policy of inbreeding with cousins through arranged marriages to keep the wealth among them. Today, there are more than 3,500 extended members of this family, controlling a fortune of over $14 billion. So John is keeping his new endeavors outside the gates of the estate. But once Mom dies in 1988, he builds facilities on the grounds for a number of athletic pursuits. Again, they're sports which aren't interactive, but soon John discovers wrestling and is introduced to Mark Schultz, who, like his brother Dave, won a gold medal in freestyle wrestling at the 1984 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. Now, Mark is the guy the 2014 film Foxcatcher was based upon, a character played by Channing Tatum. The film seemed to insinuate there was a sexual relationship of some sort between DuPont and Mark, but that doesn't appear to be verifiable in any way. Schultz denies it emphatically. Anyhow, he lives on the estate during the mid to late 1980s, and by 1991, DuPont is on the phone with Dave Schultz, who's working as a wrestling coach at Stanford University. John tells Dave he's committed to top-notch facilities, coaches, and wrestling prospects, and wants Dave to come out to Pennsylvania as soon as possible to check it out. DuPont gets other top names on the board as well, and pretty soon this Foxcatcher wrestling idea is a great one. John brings in all of this top talent, affording them the ability, through free housing and good salaries, to train without having to worry about supporting their families. This was a new experience for most American wrestlers, who were often forced out of the sport at an early age due to financial constraints. But what they can't see is that they're on the hook now. They're eating at a table with such abundance that if they dare leave, they won't find such a thing anywhere else. According to Dave's wife, these groups of families living and training together on the estate comprised a sporting utopia like they'd never experienced. It was their own little world inside those gates. Soon, however, they'd feel trapped. But when they examined the alternatives for leaving, none was remotely comparable. That's how you get lured into a cult and then find yourself unable to leave. As you become more dependent on the leader for resources, whether emotional or material, you begin to fear that you wouldn't be able to do without them. John intentionally created that type of situation because it's the same thing your boss tries to do at work. Make them dependent. Give them just enough that they remain loyal, but not enough that they can empower themselves and leave. That gives you leverage over them, both financially and emotionally. It's control. So John starts his false ascent into being one of the guys, and the alpha male, by rigging athletic events with his money to allow him to be the winner. From wrestling tournaments to decathlons, DuPont competes in a number of phony events that pit him against superior competition, pretending to lose to him. And then everybody would stand around and clap for him like he's the king. It was beyond sad. Essentially the type of thing you'd only legitimately do for a terminally ill child who wanted to be a great athlete when he grew up, but can't. This behavior feeds right into John's fantasy world. And it's so scary because it's the beginning of his self-deification process. He thinks these people see him as a god, but really, they're all conspiring to appease him to keep getting his money. Of course, along that same trajectory of self-deification, he then starts purchasing all sorts of stuff for the local and state police in order to force them into the same submissive position of allowing him to be God in exchange for his money. The DuPont Company created Kevlar, which is used in bulletproof vests, so John finds himself donating these and other types of equipment to the cause. He builds a big firing range on his estate, and not only allows the cops to come use it at their own convenience, but even gives a local police sergeant a home on the property. Soon after, he starts hunting on his land using a Lincoln town car. He drives around looking for animals and then shoots out the window at them. It's illegal, but he's already bought the cops, so who cares? Not coincidentally, that's how he ends up shooting Dave. He hunts him in the town car and shoots out the window. Now, one thing rarely discussed about DuPont, which sort of baffles me, is that this dude is a lot like Norman Bates. His father was gone from their big house on a lonely estate at a young age, and he lived there with his mother until she died, suffering the fallout of lack of socialization with his peers, leading to mental illness and murder. After college, however, he went to the South Pacific to study birds, and subsequently discovered 24 new bird species in his work as an ornithologist. Later, he would open a museum in Delaware that showcased 100,000 stuffed birds. He was obsessed with them, just as Norman Bates was. Now, John has always wanted to be the alpha male, but he also wants to be God. So the way we're going to get the theme behind his choice of Foxcatcher for the wrestling team is to not only make him the alpha predator, but also put him in the sky above with the quote-unquote bird's eye view. Accordingly, at the top of the list for predators that consume foxes are eagles. Of course, what do eagles rule? The sky. And what is John's nickname? The eagle. Foxes are rare, beautiful, and vicious predators, much like these elite wrestlers. But in comparison to an eagle, they're still inferior. They're grounded below it, with no choice but to run or hide in the face of its wrath. And that's what John wants. He desires to have these wrestlers under his thumb and at his mercy. If you watch the actual Foxcatcher promos from back in the day, not the movie, but the interviews with John, he sits there just like Norman Bates in the parlor at the motel, and he has a predatory stuffed bird, specifically an eagle, ominously staring right over his shoulder at close range. And so if you look at the name Foxcatcher, John actually manifested that name as fate. That is why he called this Foxcatcher, because it was going to lead to that place, and it did. John swooped down and he grabbed the fox. That is how it ended. Anyhow, as John starts descending into the self-deification process, he starts flying the Foxcatcher flag above the American flag on the estate. He's making a big statement that he's the ruler of his own world here. This place is more important than the grand scheme. Now, this is where all the appeasement and pacification come back to haunt the people who've allowed John to indulge ludicrous falsehoods like believing he's an elite athlete through fixed competitions. It's all good fun at first, but now John's harmless fantasies are beginning to become hallucinations. He sees things that aren't really there. And what do you think the other people will do when he does? Exactly. They're going to validate his assertions for fear of possible retribution if they don't. He starts patrolling the property on foot, holding a gun, and using a video camera to film the trees for hours at a time. He would show these videos to the wrestlers and tell them about all the creatures he could see on screen. Yet they couldn't, so they just agreed with him and validated his hallucinations. In the early days of this, it was apparent John would waver in and out of the psychosis, like there were good days and bad. So sometimes he'd desperately want you to validate things that didn't exist, and then other times he'd take you down the same path, and when you agree with him, he'd say, "That's crazy. There's nothing to see there." What's happening is that John, like a cult leader, is setting the tone for the group logic to be in tune with however he's feeling that day. If the psychosis is gripping him, they should follow suit with confirming his craziness as legit. If it wasn't, they should return to normal, like him. They even admit that the mood on the estate was controlled by John. If he was in a good mood, so was everyone else. If not, everybody was somber. So John is always right, and whatever John says is the truth. And that's what he wants. But here's the thing. Dave wouldn't appease him. He refused. And it initiates tension between them, because Dave is always making denials to John. Now, John goes on to develop different obsessions with various wrestlers. It's not a secret that it was rumored he made sexual advances toward them, though the specifics and extent of it are up to debate. None of those obsessions last, however, and I'm guessing it's for one very simple reason. John wants to get sexual favors in exchange for money, ultimately, and most of these guys simply aren't desperate enough to accommodate. Will they tell him his hallucinations are real? Sure. Will they pretend he's an elite athlete like them? Sure. But getting paid for sexual favors, or even just intimate favors, is a different beast. In that case, John is going to have to find someone desperate enough to be open to such an arrangement. Enter Valentin Jordanov. When he and John hung out at the house together, everybody else had to leave. When they were in the gym for a private wrestling session, one-on-one, everybody else had to go. If you ask me why I think Valentin was so much more receptive than the others, my instinct from watching videos of him is that he's actually suffering a similar issue. To my eyes, he's definitely gay, and the guy's married with two kids. I don't think he was ever attracted to John DuPont in any way, but I do think he comes from a very modest, foreign background that would make John's money very attractive. In all honesty, I can't bring myself to believe he's heterosexual. I think this relationship between the two was exactly what it looked like. And in the end, DuPont makes this guy the primary heir to his fortune, leaving him 80% of his estate. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. So, they were intimate on some level, and this was not just a basic friendship. Valo pretended. He played a role, and he did it for money. We're all actors like that, even if we wouldn't choose this particular role. He was much smaller than John, 5 feet 3 inches tall, 128 pounds, with a baby face and a body like a Greek god. I don't think there's much mystery here. I think the relationship was exactly what it seemed to be to outside parties. But John knows people are thinking that. So what does he do? He starts claiming the reason they became so close is that they share Bulgarian heritage. That's right. DuPont suddenly believes he isn't of French descent and is now convinced he's Bulgarian. He even begins to support Bulgarian wrestling. Now here's where the problem arises that leads to murder. Dave Schultz and Valentin are best friends, though they have a much different relationship than Valentin and John, of course. Yet in John's mind, he begins to see this as a love triangle sort of thing, in which Valentin views Dave as the alpha male, aka Foxcatcher, and not him. That makes Dave a threat to John's relationship with Valentin. So John obsesses over Dave being this threat to what he wants. Dave starts becoming part of the hallucinations. John claims Dave built a machine to control the weather, and also dug tunnels under his house, all to mess with him. He says he hears Dave in the walls. Now look at that. It frames Dave as God, right? Omnipotent. He controls the weather and can come in and out of the house, unseen, allowing him to be present and also control John's world like a deity. John can't have that. He believes he is God on this estate. He truly does. Not just that he's in control, but that he is a deity. So John, due to experiencing paranoia as a result of psychosis, hires a security team to protect himself from the wrestlers when he's the one who's the danger. Depending on the day and his mood, he'd have the security guys follow around different team members as though they're suspicious at any given moment. Soon enough, he has people on the property digging for secrets, such as the presence of mechanical trees he believes his father planted. He also speaks of mechanical deer. He has his head of security making extensive plans to uncover conspiracies all over the estate. Of course, like everybody else, that guy is getting paid well and isn't too interested in letting John know he's crazy. Instead, he validates the threats, at least to the extent of following through on the investigations without questioning their authenticity. Obviously, with John receiving validation in exchange for money, his mental health is going to deteriorate, and he isn't going to receive any type of help. By the time anyone mentions it to him, he's too far gone to be anything but angry, and subsequently believes their attempt at helping him is a conspiracy against him. Now, we've talked in the past about how a person descending into psychosis abandons logic conducive to social meaning and proceeds to adopt evolutionary context. This is when John begins to do that. His brain is taking over and communicating through symbolism and metaphor because he is unable to make rational decisions at this point. So, Kevin Jackson, one of the top wrestlers at Foxcatcher, is forced to leave the estate and also the team. When he asks why, he's told it's because he's black. Of course, this is shocking to him, and also to the other black athletes on the farm, who are also told to take a hike. But just as he's thinking he's the victim of racism, he learns John is demanding that everything black be removed from his property. He sells all the black horses and makes two of the wrestlers get rid of a black car and a black van, respectively. Nobody is allowed to wear a black shirt anymore. As hurt as Kevin Jackson was by this move, believing it was definitely racist, and rightfully so, he later changed his position on the matter when he learned about the nature of psychosis. John was descending into darkness emotionally, and it manifested in trying to remove any darkness from his view in the material world. Unfortunately, as the place was already running like a cult, the other wrestlers just accepted this move as something they couldn't control. There was no rebellion. It says a lot about how people can form without leverage. That's the type of thing that happens in a cult. You continue to conform because you have less and less leverage as your time there goes on. So the other wrestlers were afraid to lose what they had, so they didn't stand up to John over this incident. It's a microcosm of how and why people will conform to support tyranny and injustice. Now, what's really interesting is that when John later went to prison and subsequently became further depressed and psychotic, he paid contractors to paint most of the houses on the estate black. The darkness closed in on him emotionally, so he, once again, allowed it to manifest in physicality, this time on the houses. Of course, the ones that got painted black were the former houses of the wrestlers, signifying the grief John experienced after losing his beloved Foxcatcher program. In some ways, it was the only family he ever had. Killing Dave cost him that. And so he paints the wrestler's former houses black to mourn the past, to mourn what's gone. If you want to know just how important the Foxcatcher endeavor was to John, how close it was to his heart, just consider he elected to be buried in his red Foxcatcher wrestling singlet. It was 2010 by then, and he still wanted that. Now, what's even worse about this situation, with the black athletes being fired from the Foxcatcher team, is that USA Wrestling learns of this atrocity, and what do? Nothing. Why? DuPont is giving them $400,000 a year in support. That's back in the 1990s. So people are still silent because John is creating financial opportunities that didn't exist before. Their inability to forego that support makes them do things they normally wouldn't. Dave gets $70,000 a year and a house for his family on a private estate, which is unbeatable for a wrestling coach in the 1990s. At this point, John is doing a lot of coke and drinking quite a bit as well. He roams the halls of his house all night, paranoid even beyond what he's been in the past. He thinks he has bugs under his skin and scratches at them to get them out. The hallucination of physical bugs trying to exit the body while you desperately scratch at them is a manifestation of the idea of your emotions eating at you. They're crawling around beneath the surface, but you can't get them to leave. Now, what's the most likely emotional value you desire to manifest on a physical level if you were experiencing psychosis and feeling tortured? Peace. Accordingly, our boy John starts wearing a red robe and calling himself the Dalai Lama. It kills two birds with one stone. He gets to be a deity of sorts, while also representing the physical manifestation of peace. John chose a position of both peace and power. He isn't going to sacrifice one for the other, which means he isn't getting any help either. Now, this is when John starts carrying his Tech 9 all over the property. The Tech 9 is a semi-automatic pistol that gained infamy in the 1990s as a favorite of gangsters. There's hardly a gangster rap song from that era that doesn't mention this weapon. Perhaps even more notoriously, Dylan Klebold carried a Tech 9 during the Columbine Massacre in 1999. It can be fired with either one hand like a pistol, or, for greater accuracy, it can be held with both hands like it's a mini machine gun. It also has a large 22-round magazine, making it popular for crimes like drive-by shootings in which you don't have an opportunity to reload but need something compact that can be transported and easily fired from within a moving vehicle. Now, this is when John begins randomly booting people off the property. All it takes is for him to see you, and suddenly he believes there's a conspiracy against him. Another wrestler named Dan is asked to leave, but he doesn't because there's no rhyme or reason to the demand. So John parks a U-Haul in front of his house to send a message, yet the guy still doesn't move out. So John shows up in the gym while Dan is lifting weights and screams at him while also pointing the Tech 9 in his face. Dan, of course, decides it's time to go, but in the meantime, he calls the cops and tells them about this incident. He's worried John is dangerous. The cops, though, are taking John's money and materials, so they just laugh and play it off as John being eccentric, as usual, the same line everybody loves to use. So Dan obviously agrees to pack up and leave at this point. But in the meantime, before he gets off the property, the house directly next to his on the estate burns down overnight. It's a message. He goes to USA Wrestling. This time they've had enough. They say they're going to turn away John's money because he's dangerous. And tragically, who talks them out of it? Dave Schultz. He says if he thought for one second John was dangerous, he wouldn't have his wife and children on the property. Unfortunately, Dave was in denial because John was offering him a financial situation he could never find elsewhere. He didn't want to let go due to this, and also had the Olympics coming up. John was obviously dangerous and deteriorating beyond acceptability. So Dan leaves and is no longer the object of John's fury. But when he does, he takes the moving truck and leaves his van at Dave's house. Remember, in psychosis, physical movement can equate to emotional values. So John comes to believe there's a conspiracy against him among Dave and Dan, rather than some dude just leaving his van while he takes care of relocating. But look at the emotional value that results from it. John thinks he can't trust Dave. Soon after, the guy comes back for his van. When John learns this, he gets drunk and goes to Dave's house with a rifle while the kids are there. Dave convinces him to put the weapon down, but John proceeds to fall over and split his head open on a windowsill near the doorway. When he wakes up the next day, he doesn't remember how it happened, or even getting stitches by a doctor. He asks someone who wasn't present what he thinks might have caused the wound. The guy says it looks like he got hit with a baseball bat. He's just taking a guess, though. But John calls the cops and tells them he thinks Dan attacked him with a bat while he was on the property. Of course, the cops interview Dave Schultz, and Dave is able to relay the truth John can't remember. Unfortunately for him, John views this as a betrayal. He thinks Dave is siding with Dan and lying about what happened. Dave's wife wants to leave, but the Olympic trials are 6 months away, so Dave says they'll move back to California after the Olympics. The 1996 Summer Olympic Games were not only going to be Dave's last as a competitor, given his age, but they were being hosted in the USA, as they had been in 1984 when he medaled in Los Angeles. To interrupt his training and uproot his life would have been detrimental to his goals in addition to the team's goals. A lot of these guys had Olympic aspirations. He understood that. So John's behavior has become more and more erratic. During this time, the wrestlers refer to the farm as the solar system, and the best tip anyone can give you is to not get too close to the sun or you'll get burnt. Of course, the sun is John's house and John himself within its walls. He was paranoid, armed most of the time, and incredibly unpredictable. He scared people. It wouldn't be long before he finally went over the edge. It was never really a question of if, it was always when. And that day became January 26, 1996. In the year leading up to it, DuPont did all sorts of outrageous things, from making physical threats to driving his car into a pond on his property before getting a rental car and doing it again the next day with a passenger in the back seat. He was out of control, but they all needed him. And it's so sad, because underneath the madness was a kind, sad man who had some good days when he was able to overcome his illness. He didn't have the support around him to corner him in a place of no leverage where he felt like he had to get help, or else. There were no consequences for him, only for them. And so they feared John withdrawing his financial support. In turn, he got no help, and there wasn't going to be any chance that he would. By the time they actually mentioned to him, "Hey John, maybe you could get help, maybe you could just get some medicine to fix this," he was in a state of mind in which he likely would have been considered someone who could be admitted involuntarily. His behavior repeatedly rendered a portrait of an exceedingly wealthy, reckless, and mentally ill man running rampant through his kingdom, armed with guns and firing at will. This was a real thing. He was privileged enough to be able to do it. But on January 26th, Dave is at the gym coaching other wrestlers and has the word KIDS written on his forehead in black marker and also on one of his palms. If John was going to point a gun at him, he was not only going to put up his hands, but the messages on his forehead and on one of the hands would remind John about Dave's kids. John was very kind to them and generous. They had holidays and birthdays at each other's homes. Dave got close to John when others didn't want to. He seemed to genuinely care about the guy, but didn't know how to handle him. And John's mind was gone at this point. He was convinced Dave Schultz was hiding in the walls of his home after digging tunnels underneath it and conspiring against him with Dan by having the guy's van at his place for a short time. But the worst infraction in John's warped mind is that Dave had a strong, genuine friendship with Valentin that took the focus off John as the king of the hill. John had the money, that's for certain. But Dave truly had the respect of these men. John left 80% of his estate to Valentin when he died, so it's pretty clear to me that John was in love with him. This was considered a romantic relationship. He saw Dave as part of a love triangle that didn't exist. Yes, Valentin was married, but he did all of the private one-on-one sessions in John's home and at the gym that the other wrestlers didn't do. John got close to these guys, one by one, until he found the person who was most like him and also more desperate than the others for his support. Jordanov didn't want to go back home, and John was supporting him. There wasn't a better opportunity waiting in Bulgaria. So he went for the cash and got it. A whole lot of it. Anyhow, it was that simple. John wanted Dave gone. Not off the property like the rest of the guys. No, DuPont wanted Dave Schultz to literally disappear off the face of the earth, because that's the way he was dealing with things at the time. Everything was manifesting physically, so it's not like he could approach Dave and say, "Hey, I want to ask you about your relationship with Valentin." He's so far gone into the psychosis, something like that is not even a possibility, and given his social issues to begin with, it really wasn't possible to start. So on that fateful day, John summons his head of security to get in his car. They drive over to Dave's place, where Dave and his wife just finished lunch. Supposedly Dave was outside working on their car. DuPont pulls up outside the house, and Dave, as most people would do if their boss arrived, walks over to the driver's window. At that moment, John lifts his right arm, which is holding the gun, and points it out the window. Before Dave can even blink, John shoots the man multiple times with his wife watching. The head of security is like, "What the hell are you doing?" and gets out of the vehicle slowly, scared for his life. John quickly drives back to the main house, where he lives, and hides inside, thereby instructing the head of security to not let police in when they show up. So consider that for a moment. The question will arise in court as to whether or not John was sane at the time of the murder. He'll spend all sorts of money trying to prove he's insane, but this effort will fail from the start. Let's take a look. John shoots Dave. What's the first thing he does after that? He takes off, suggesting he knows what he did was wrong. He hides, admitting he knows people will be looking to get him now when they're not even chasing him yet. And then he admits he realizes the consequences of his actions by instructing his head of security to not let police in when they're not even on the way yet. In short, he knows what he's done is wrong and is expecting to face consequences. That's not a great way to establish insanity. But he is still definitively mentally ill. When he gets back to the property, a standoff with the cops is soon to follow. While on the phone with them as the cops attempt to negotiate a surrender, John says His Holiness is under siege at the holy property. The self-deification as a result of psychosis is, of course, apparent, but he still seems to understand right and wrong. John tells the cops he's not coming out because he has important papers to look over. He describes himself as a head of state and is annoyed they're bothering him over such a petty matter. He refuses right into the night, and the cops are going to use kid gloves because he provides them a lot of money and gear. He says he's decided to go to sleep for the night, and they still don't even bother to send in the SWAT team that's already on the premises. They allow him to go to bed safely, but they turn off the heat at his place to try to gently push him out in the cold winter. So John eventually gets on the phone with them and asks if he can have a guy come out and look at the heat to get it running again. They tell him no, so he asks if he can do it, like if he can go fix it himself. DuPont really thinks he's going to leave his home during a standoff, walk to the building where the heating equipment is housed, and potentially do repairs. Of course, they tell him yes because it makes him a sitting duck. Now, remember how he wanted to get everything black off the farm, up to and including black shirts? He tells the cops that he'll be coming out wearing a black t-shirt. So as he did in prison with painting the houses black, wearing the black t-shirt symbolizes his depression or darkness. He knows everything is coming to an end. The fantasy is dying. John wanted to kill Dave to fix his problems, but what he needed to do was get help. He chose not to, and when the time came, he couldn't rationally make that decision for himself anymore. The people closest to him failed to take control due to fear. In the end, it was tragic for everyone involved, from the victim and his family to the wrestlers who'd made this place a utopia, only to see it crumble. In the end, as tragic as it is, John chose a solution that would both satisfy his desire to be rid of Dave and his need for this prolonged circus to finally end. Like so many of the criminals I've talked about, he tried to satisfy both sides of a dilemma without emotional innovation and paid the ultimate price for it. He had to let go of a misguided belief that Dave was plotting against him. He couldn't. He was not able to do that. In the aftermath, I think what haunts me about this case is that Valentin Jordanov, Dave Schultz's best friend, didn't turn his back on John DuPont in light of the murder. He remained at Foxcatcher, as did some other guys. Some of them left, and others didn't. The allegiance to the two was mixed, despite John being a horrible human being and Dave being a good guy. The truth is John had the money, the training facilities, the housing, the estate, and influence. With the 1996 Olympic trials right around the corner, there was a lot at stake. Too much for some of them to consider moving on. So they turned their heads, as they always had. Jordanov chose DuPont over supporting his best friend's family. I ask myself, if a man I knew murdered my best friend, who had a wife and two children, would I remain in his life, moving forward, knowing that he had the opportunity to get help for his problems again and again, and chose not to? The answer is no. But John DuPont had enough money to make it yes for a young man like Jordanov, who went on to win gold in Atlanta that summer. He had a family. He didn't want to go back to Bulgaria without a promising future. It isn't right, but it's the truth. the world they lived in for all those years on the farm was like that. So is ours. And so I wonder, as I look at this guy who collected millions of dollars for what essentially amounts to selling his soul, how could he do this? Why did he do this? He didn't do the right thing. He chose what was best for him. And I guess it makes me realize that, on some level, we are all facing that question of morality with each decision we make. Are we doing the right thing? Or doing it for ourselves? Sometimes I don't know. Sometimes I'm afraid of the truth. Maybe you are too. But I think what scares me the most, and what scared John the most, is that someone will hold me accountable to it. They'll tell me what I refuse to hear, and show me what I refuse to see. There will be nowhere to hide from that light, from what I am, the monster I've become. Yet, when we're forced to look at our reflection in the mirror, that's never what we see. We expect a gruesome, horrifying, evil creature. And what we really get is much worse. It's a hopeless, flawed human being with nowhere left to run. We're trapped. And these choices we make, they're the directions in which we travel toward hope. They consist of a seemingly endless maze, always twisting and turning, offering surprises around each corner, before culminating in a dead end. But in the meantime, it's up to us to choose how we should play the game. And in a world where no one leaves a winner, there are as many answers to that question as there are people. Because in this maze, the only destination is what happens next. You never escape. There isn't a route to freedom. It doesn't offer right or wrong in its design. The only thing that matters is what you do to make living inside this game bearable. Sometimes we dream. More often we pretend. But what we always do, without fail, is whatever we think will keep us from giving up. And sometimes the truth resulting from that idea is too ugly to acknowledge. That was the case with John DuPont. He didn't know how to genuinely give or receive love. He didn't know how to tell people it hurts, and that he was scared. Money can buy you a lot of really amazing things, but your authentic self is not one of them. John couldn't face the sad reality waiting for him in the mirror each morning. He drank, took pills, and descended into psychosis to cope with it. So I think what we learned from Valentin Jordanov is that maybe the best way to thrive is to make choices you can live with, right or wrong. otherwise, you become John. So when the dreaded task of looking in the mirror is yours, and you fear the reflection staring back, knowing that monster is waiting to swallow you, please remember that regardless of what you see, the only thing that matters is hope.